Mavericks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Movie Mavericks, speaking of fucking long, uncut European cocks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
I can't wait.
Hey now, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast. This is our retrospective on Mission Impossible 2.
The good one.
The good one?
The John Woo version of Mission Impossible 2. We can say that at least, right?
I don't know if it's a... It's a good one. I'll say that much.
This is the 2000s highest grossing film, Mission Impossible 2. The highest grossing in the series also. It sold the most tickets adjusted.
And highest grossing, how much did it make?
It made $212 million in
2000. Isn't that so crazy? What's adjusted? Do you know adjusted?
Adjusted is like $330 million. It's unfucking believable. This was the year's top earner, and it's not hard to see. It was also an international hit, made $538 million, half a billion dollars worldwide, which adjusted has to be getting close to that billion-dollar mark. Do you prefer Mission Impossible 2 to Mission Impossible 1?
No, I like the first one more. I have a way to describe this franchise very succinctly, and that's that every film is just another swing of the pendulum, right? Mission Impossible 1's to one side, 2 goes a complete opposite direction, 3 goes back the other way, 4 goes a little bit more the other way, and then 5, in my mind, 5 pretty much nails exactly what these movies should be going forward.
I say 5, I would agree that 5 nails where it is at now, the present version of this, or where it always should have been. But this one, number 2, is such a pure fantasy, such a pure spectacle that this was also, I think, the last time we got a spy movie that wasn't directly influenced by the Bourne movies, that didn't have the shaky cam, that didn't have... the over-reliance on digital technology and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's some cell phone usage here, but not every character is glued to it in a laptop. There's a lot of dare-doing here going on. And for an adventure-slash-spy movie, there's a pretty big romantic angle to this movie. A lot more so going back. This is more of a love story, romantic kind of adventure action film than I recall before. Did you get that vibe?
Yeah, no, I did not at all. I don't think there's any romance in this whatsoever. There's a couple of John Woo oddity slow motion things that are supposed to be, I guess, romantic things. But, I mean, realistically, this is a wham-bam thank you man kind of a thing as far as I'm concerned, especially in the beginning. And then he kind of just sends her off on her way, and they're really not together through the majority of this movie.
This was written by Robert Towne, who won the Oscar for Chinatown, which is universally known as, the most perfectly written screenplay of all time structurally. And he's written quite a few movies for Cruise, including Days of Thunder and the first Mission Impossible. They really, it felt like to me, simplified this one, maybe overly simplified it because of complaints that the first one was too complicated.
It was too hard, yeah.
And because
which is a good complaint.
But I appreciate that this story really is just a clothesline for the action set pieces. Did that bother you at all?
No, not really. I mean, because it wasn't, there was no attempt to be anything more, you know? So I think that saves this movie, even though, you know, there is really no plot. The plot's so basic, you know, it's your basic stealing what virus, right? Worldwide
MacGuffin, really.
Virus that could kill everyone, but it really doesn't. I mean, the virus really never poses a threat ever, which is interesting. And the bad guy doesn't even. That's the other thing about this movie is the bad guy, I thought was fairly weak. I mean, what do you think about that? He doesn't. He never. He's so stupid. He doesn't even know he doesn't have the virus. And through half the movie, for more than half the movie, right? He just doesn't have the virus. So he's really not. He's nothing. He's no threat to anyone.
I actually think this is probably one of the best villains of the series, conversely. I thought that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character was probably the most well-acted villain and the scariest in the third one, but didn't do anything in that as well. And the fourth and the fifth one, I really couldn't even remember the villains in those. They were so unmemorable. And the first one, you know, John Voight turned the Jim Phelps character, who was the main character, into the bad guy, which, you know, which would be a big faux pas nowadays, but they didn't have any problem doing that back in 96. And that just, to me, was such a cop-out ending of the first one that at least I felt in this story, they gave a guy who was
supposed
to be... There's
no cop-out to the end of this movie.
Oh, yeah, we'll get into that.
Come
this
on.
Is, the story structure here is based on the Hitchcock classic Notorious, about a guy sending his lover into, you know, behind enemy lines to get involved with her ex-lover for information. That movie is very well done with what it's doing. And I like the fact that Town went looked for a classical inspiration to at least add something, because this really could have been as little or minimalistic as it is now. It could have been even less. In lesser hands.
Well, would you say, I mean, one of my main problems with John Woo's American stuff is that I don't feel he has a grasp really on the language. He just doesn't seem to understand. His film, his technique choices are odd, to say the least. And they're very Hong Kong, they're very Asian. And I love his Hong Kong movies and stuff. But to me, they don't translate very well. I'm guessing they do for you. You said you liked a lot of this stuff. I told you that... I'll set you up here, because I told you you can't talk about any movie being too cheesy ever again.
I know.
Because there are moments in this, there are actually a couple of slow motion parts that are just odd, to say the least. But when they first meet and they have the car race, which is a great sequence and scene. But that when the cars lock and you get that slow motion and the wind's blowing through the hair and they're looking at each other and they're supposed to be falling in love.
It works for me.
Are
I don't know why.
Are you kidding me?
I told you this. Look, I got to be honest. This movie is a movie that I have no intellectual defense for. I cannot defend it on any sort of
– It just like, flows.
But it just – I respond to it viscerally. I mean, it moves for me. The structure of it, the way that the movie plays out, the actual physical movement within the frame on some shots
That's
is
fair,
so
because
beautiful it, that it just plays for me.
John Woo is such a great action director. I mean, there's no denying that.
And this movie is edited to fucking perfection. Their editing in this movie is beautiful. Mm-hmm. The sound design, when Naya's running up the stairs and the ladies are doing their dance routine with the tap dancing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that works beautifully. And that's not even an action beat, but that just goes to show you the kind of thought that was put into this.
But there are moments when she first steps off the boat and walks up the dock, right? When she first goes into the arms of her ex-lover, right? She's going undercover and she finally meets... you know, meets again.
Right.
The bad guy. And actually, what's the character?
Ambrose.
Ambrose, thank you. And that moment where he catches the scarf as it flies off her neck.
That's Joe Woo, baby.
But doesn't that feel like, you know, the scene is happening. These are the important parts that are happening in the scene. Oh, no, wait, let's stop and I don't understand any of that. Let's do this where the scarf flies off you and you grab it. And like, let's just add this extra stuff in here because I don't know what the hell's going on.
That's
John Woo to me. That's what it feels like.
You know, what's funny is I see that as this. I was watching that scene, and as it played out, I remembered exactly what was going to happen. I thought put that scarf on her like, I want this to blow off and catch it. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely the Woo touch, but that's what you get, those kind of eccentricities with Woo. The good comes with the bad with Woo.
Is that any different, though? And I'll say this because I have problems with other directors for similar things, Tim Burton being one that all his worlds look the same. But with John Woo, he doesn't really set design and stuff, right? But instead it's motion and action and things and whatnot. So he's kind of doing that here, putting his stamp on it, on every movie that he makes is like that. Much like Tim Burton's worlds, you know, or Makes sense, I think.
I think that I was never – well, I know this. I was never a fan of John Woo's Hong Kong work, which is the strange thing. I prefer all of his American movies, including Hard Target, to all the stuff he did there. I know The
Hard
Killers
Target's
and Bullet
good.
To the Head and all that kind of stuff. It is. So is Face Off, which you refuse to admit.
Face Off is fine, but Face Off tries too hard. That was the other question I had since you bring it up. Do you think John Woo got this role or this director job at all because of Face Off? Because they're like this guy knows how to change faces. Yeah.
Well, not only that, you think the next movie that Cruise did, he was Vanilla Sky, where he's, you know, pulling off a mask on his face too, and he's some weird sort of mask thing going on here. And even was it Minority Report after that, where he got the face changing stuff? So, but getting back to this one, I think this was basically the beginning of the end for Wu. This was the high point for his American career. This mm-hmm. was the high point. And after this, he would have Wind Talkers, which I respect, but is flawed. And then the movie we can both agree is dog shit is Paycheck, which actually pretty much ended his career as a director here in America. So this would be the big point for him. Directing wise, and there was a reportedly tension on the set between he and Cruise. And let's not forget that the first director that was supposed to be attached to this was Oliver Stone. Now, can you imagine what Stone would have done with this material? I mean, he would have botched the shit.
It would have been really bad.
yeah, I agree.
I mean, no doubt whatsoever, he would not have been right for this. I don't know. It's still really nice to have this in the franchise because. It's so different. And every one of these movies, I said, have been a swinging pendulum, you know, from left to right. And they really, they zig and they zag. And that's the fun of this franchise. Now, is that fun over since, you know, to put it into perspective, Mission Impossible 5 is kind of the Fast and Furious 7, right, of the bunch. So it's kind of found that footing now. And people have these expectations from it. So that fun of the series, for me anyways, might be over.
I hope not, because I hope that wasn't the high point. You know, I really hope that's not the high point now. They're cooking this next one up a little quicklier than they have been. So we're getting the next one, I think, in 2 years. And it's been an average of 4 to 6 years between sequels. So we'll see.
Ramping it up.
I think Robert Rodriguez should have helmed one of these at some point.
Yeah, that would be fun. I know.
I think he could have done this installment.
They should keep doing it. I think they should just keep, you know, mixing it up and everything. We were talking about this mixing up, and you know, you had said there's nothing else out there that really does this, and you're right, because James Bond is really the only other movie franchise you can compare this to in that sense. But and it does switch up, but it takes you know a couple movies before it switches up, and it's an abrupt switch up, just like these are. But this has been, with every kind of movie, has been a complete change up.
In fact, the next one though will be directed once again by Christopher McQuarrie at this point. So interesting to see if they're sticking with McQuarrie right now. But Cruise has used his services as a writer for quite some time and let him do Jack Reacher for a debut. I take that back. Mm-hmm. His debut is Way of the Gun, but it did a big, big feature debut here with Jack Reacher, and now he's doing two Mission Impossible movies. You know, original director of photography, Andrew Lesney, was released on this film, and they always said it was due to Wu and he having creative differences. Do you recall when we were in film school, and one of our infamous teachers who had a grudge against everyone in Hollywood spoke of this? Do you recall any of this conversation?
I don't know.
All right. You know exactly who I'm talking about as well. That bitch. Anyways, she said that Andrew Lesney was fired because he was not lighting Cruise properly. You recall this. And he went on, immediately got hired on for the Lord of the Rings movies, which he would win an Oscar for. So I don't think
he helped him out.
Yeah, no love lost there, I'm sure. But Jeffrey Kimball was brought in, who had shot Days of Thunder. But a few other big Tom Cruise films, and really a lot of movies. So, movie looks great, right? I mean, the look of this thing is beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Well, yeah, well, all John Woo movies look great, but yeah, I mean, shot well, of course. It's cost enough money, so hope that it would. Right? I mean, 2000. This was when movies were slick at this point. You know, they all looked good.
Yeah, this is the summer, I think, this was a great summer for movies when this came out. This came out in the same, you know, month there of Gladiator, this, Gone in 60 Seconds, which is a guilty pleasure of mine, Coyote Ugly, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of things playing in the Cineplex. I will, twice. And it just, a good summer for action films. And like you said, that slickness, that would give way later to, you know, the Matrix influence stuff that really hadn't caught on at this point yet. It was too early. The next year you'd see more of that kind of stuff.
This was a bit in the middle. I mean, when you look at the a couple of years before, the first Mission Impossible is very 90s and it has a very 90s feel to it. This kind of has a mixed feel. There's a lot of 90s here, but there's also a lot of future 2000s here as well.
yeah, new age filmmaking. Let's listen to the trailer here. I'll give you a little snippet of what audiences got. We'll come back and we'll break down the story.
Good morning, Mr. Hunt.
Sorry I barged in on your vacation.
Well, Mr. Hunt, I don't quite know where to begin.
You know me?
No. Should I?
She's got no training for this kind of thing.
But to go to bed with a man and lie to him, she's a woman. She's got all the training she needs.
Welcome to Australia, mate.
This ain't funny.
The mother of all nightmares is on the loose.
I don't think I can do it.
You mean it'll be difficult?
Very.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
You gotta be kidding.
This message will destruct in 5 seconds.
All right, and we're back here to talk with you to Mission Impossible 2, the story. This movie takes place really a while, obviously, after the events of Mission Impossible 1, where he was disavowed and worked his way back into the service. What's strange about this is to me is that there's no sort of like lingering resentment for the fact that the IMF team went after him. You know, the special force, he was on the outs and now he's everything's all good and he's working back for him. You know, there's no like lingering hangover from that first movie. He trusts everybody.
No, of course not.
And
reset.
The first few moments of this movie are extremely awkward to me. Always have been. And I think they still are with the kids playing Ring Around the Rosie, you know, which is obviously was about the Black Plague back in the day.
Well, it's a John Woo problem, you know. I think it's just shot wrong.
Is that what it is? Because the first 3 or 4 minutes of this movie are so bizarre to me.
It feels tacked on as well.
About characters we don't know who they are yet in situations that are...
It's all set up to be flashback to later on, right? Which it is. But it's even that flashback scene where he's remembering him
isn't worth a shit.
Actually, he says they go through that whole speech that Vladimir or whatever the fuck
right
says, you know, this whole speech several times during the movie, and every time he says it, it is about as impactful as the first time, which is about nothing, none. You know, so I don't know why they even bother with it, but that is kind of the driving force, I guess, in this movie. I can't even remember what the speech is, but there's something about it that they try to parlay into whoever's listening to it right at the time, get something out of it. It's just, it doesn't work.
What does work, though, is the following scene where they're on the airplane and we get our first glimpse of what we think is Cruise. Turns out to be the bad guy wearing a face mask. They kill everyone on the plane and they eject, or they all deploy at 30,000 feet.
Which is a great setup.
Great sequence and a cool way to do the voice problem of the face masks with the little computerized chip on the neck. I thought was a nice, clever way of you know your face off problem where Travolta and Kate
was that not
bodies.
In the first one?
I don't recall that being in the first one at all.
I feel that was in the first one.
Maybe it was. Maybe I didn't pick up on it as much as I did in the second one here.
Well, shit, I can't remember though. But yeah, I mean, I agree. It's to start off with, that's great because that the whole face. Face off, if you will, plays such a huge role throughout the rest of this entire movie.
I think more so than in any other entry that this is the one that uses the mask.
Oh, yeah, this one just goes bonkers with it. They love it.
Yeah, they really.
Which,
do.
If you did have that technology, wouldn't you use it?
It's a great way to get around story problems and plot holes too, or as maybe navigate a few of them as possible. And then we meet Cruz, who's hanging out on a rock, and this has got to be the dumbest scene in all of the Mission Impossible movies. I hate this sequence. I really do.
Really? Like this to me, no, I don't like it. But this, again, is a setting of the scene of it kind of sets up the entire movie because it's really him, right?
Yeah, he's alone. He's doing a solitary deal. Yeah, and this is a very Tom Cruise movie in the sense that this is him at the height of his box office powers, his stardom. I mean, he could do no wrong at this point. He's got the flowing locks. I mean, this guy damn near looks like a girl in some parts with the hair. And they shoot him lovingly in this movie. It gets gorgeous close-ups, and you know what I mean? He's framed in particular ways. But once again, I think that this is a very – as much as I hate the opening of Part 4 where he's too cool for school, I get that vibe from this nowadays when I watch it.
I do too, but I think this is handled much better than at least that one. At least here he's goal-oriented. He's doing something. You know, it's for that. Himself, but he's still doing it. He's not showing off to anyone. There's no one else around. He's doing it literally for himself, you know, whereas in the other one – it really felt like he not only was playing to other characters, but he was playing to the fourth wall. You know, he was playing to us as the audience. And that was just like, dude, really? You don't have to like, you don't really have to turn to me and be like, eh, aren't I cool? You know, wink at me and shit. Like, come on.
It was a Deadpool moment.
Yeah. That's not in the movie, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. I get that vibe exactly from it. And I would take this over the third, I guess, where he's set up at a housewarming party for, or an engagement party for him and his, well, you know, if you can get fiance, but. That's a terrible scene in the third one. But however, this one, after that, we get Anthony Hopkins, who's introduced as what is mission control guy. And I really like that. I like the fact that Anthony Hopkins is the actor here that gives him his mission. I feel like the sequence between
he's barely like, in it and it doesn't matter.
But, you know, it can be anyone. I like that exchange they have between the two. And the fact that he goes to Seville, that's a great sequence in Spain. I think that's the score here. We can't even discount the score by Hans Zimmer.
The score is one of the great Hans Zimmer scores.
Working with Lisa Gerrard, and they're very much in their gladiator mode here in this, you know, those kind of hymns and beautiful sounding melodies that they're doing here. But he does give it a Spanish vibe at parts. And I love that sequence in Spain, especially I know his our classic John Woo slow motion first time, the slowdown with the dresses in the sequence when they're walking by each other. I love that moment when they first get a glimpse at each other. In that little club there. I really do.
And I also will say that this is, you know, Tom Cruise always has that kind of vulnerability in these movies. And here we are again, when he first meets her, he's kind of screwing around with her here and there, but she definitely is more or less in control. He's just kind of there seeing what's what. And when they go back to the car and she takes off and he kind of fumbles a little bit.
I love that.
I just thought, there it is. You know, there's that little piece that has been expanded on further on down the line, especially when you get to number 5 and they really have mastered that.
I'm glad that you pointed that out because that's a keen eye. I thought that was great too. That he, you know, he's sudden to him. He didn't expect her to take off like that. You know what I mean? Like his arrogance worked against him.
Exactly.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And then, you know, right into that, we get the most arrogant scene of all where he comes out of nowhere. He's got her phone and, you know, he does her a solid by smacking her car off the fucking cliff there and saving her life.
A beautiful moment where they fall in love. They lock eyes as they're about to die.
I fucking love that shit. I mean, for whatever reason, that slow motion Woo stuff with the music going in the hair flowing on both of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Thandi Newton has never been more beautiful than she is in this movie. She is gorgeous in this film. Would you agree?
Great.
She is fucking flawless in this movie. And she had a very bit role in Interview with a Vampire. We'll be talking about that, I think, some shows down the road, where she played a house servant to Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. And she looked very unassuming and whatnot. I barely even remembered in the movie. And I remember seeing her in this thinking, you know, my goodness, this is just an absolute screen beauty. And I don't know why her career didn't go further.
Chronicles of Riddick. I mean, do I have to go on?
Yeah, right. That was probably the high point. But I think this is my favorite – I don't want to say Bond girl, but that's kind of what she is. I think this is my favorite female lead of the entire
because
series.
She's not a Bond girl, right? I mean, that's one great thing I still think about the series. It's so great is that as far as sexism goes with in James Bond, you know, he's always the man and the women are kind of women and they're.
No, she has actually a plot function in this.
No shit. She's useful. But not only that, she's the person. She survives on her own. She is Ethan Hunt. She's the girl version of Ethan Hunt. You know, I love that they always bring the females in this up to par with him, if not better than him in many ways. And that's part of that, as you say, like his cockiness kind of gets the best of him.
Yeah, he thinks he's bulletproof in a lot of ways, and he is to men, but like it doesn't always work with the female aspect. You know, he gets kind of tongue-tied a little. He's not as suave as Bond. He does fall in love. And you know, the new James Bonds are obviously touching on that a lot more than the old ones did. But in this era, you know, Bond was a one-hit wonder with the girls, so... This movie shows Cruise too, I think, trying to take chances in the fact that this was this is him really going – this first time he fired a gun in a movie. Let's not forget that. Now he's doing pretty much only action movies, but he never fired a gun on screen outside of Born on the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. Here he is double-fisted with guns, running around, you know, doing crazy shit. And this was kind of – I felt like always his coming out party as a leading action hero. You know, like, this is what I can do now. And going back and forth from Magnolia to this – to Vanilla Sky, to Minority Report. It was mixing up the commercial with the critical stuff. And I just thought this movie was such a great career move for him. It's such a right time. This movie could really only have existed, I felt like, in the year 2000.
Yeah. Know,
pre 9/11, pre, you know, what we know now about world politics and just, you know, how not innocent we are anymore as a nation. And this movie still played – when I watched this, I still felt like the kind of – innocence, just watching this and thinking, well, this is great that we have that superhero that's going to go and take down all these terrorisms and stuff like that. But getting to the crux of this movie, what is the problem with the sending the girlfriend back into the boyfriend? Do you see the whole plot issue here with that? I mean, let's talk about some plot holes. Because this movie was 3.5 hours long on initial cut, which makes no sense to me.
I don't remember that. There's a plot hole with that?
There was a plot hole leading up to that. In the fact that they've slept together once and she's supposed to have no conscience. So why is she still hanging around to meet him back at the hotel when he asks her to do this?
Do you ever wonder about that? She does have a conscience. Where does it say that?
She says she's a thief. Okay.
She can say whatever she wants, but I mean, actions are.
Okay. I always thought if she was really, you know, not into him like she had proclaimed.
But she clearly is.
That's the problem here. You don't think this is a romantic movie in the sense of that? Like, what's what they're trying to go for here?
And what they're trying to go for? I guess because you have two people who are in love with each other, but it's not a romantic movie in the sense that, you know, these aren't star-crossed lovers or anything, right? They just happen to be doing the same. There's a lot of times when he doesn't really seem to give two shits about her, and she doesn't seem to give two shits about him, mainly because they're not together through the most of the movie. But I don't know. There's a fighting that you have to admit I think the greatest part of the movie is when she injects herself, right?
Beyond the best. I mean, music wise
is amazing.
That cue kicks in. I mean,
but that's one of the moments in the movie that'll get you no matter what. You're just thinking, oh my gosh, yes, that's perfectly directed. It's perfectly timed. It's perfectly everything. But she's only thinking of herself when she does it. Really,
she doesn't get killed.
He's there, really not thinking of her. Right, his whole being there has jack shit. He doesn't give two shit. I mean, if she gets killed, if her cover's blown, whatever, he doesn't care. He's there to steal that, to get rid of that virus. You know, they have their.
He almost shoots her at one point.
Yeah, so I don't know. There's that moment when she injects herself and she looks at him. He's like, "Fuck no!" You know, why the fuck would you do that? Like, you know, I could have gotten you out of it some other way. I don't know. You know, there are moments in this movie that are contradictory to other moments.
I love that scene though, when basically the I'll find you scene, you know, is better to me there than in Last of the Mohicans, when he then runs and jumps out of the I prefer that sequence better than the Last of the Mohicans, honestly. Okay. I mean, the music and
apparently
everything going on.
You prefer the William Shatner climbing a mountain in Star Trek V as opposed to this as
well.
But that's fine, you know,
too.
That's fine.
Row, row, row your boat. Oh my goodness, that little Star Trek humor for y'all. Anyways, so we're getting back to this one here, though. But when Anaya injects herself and that musical cue kicks in, and this movie really goes into its third act at that point, it is really – I'm all on board at that point. But what I think about the villain in this too is great is that he freely admits that he's just banging this chick. He knows full on that what she's doing, and he's just using her for some sex. So really, she's the most helpless character in the whole fucking movie. It's really kind of a misogynistic outlook on what's going on here. And is it me, or is his henchman a little homoerotic for him? Is there a weird jealousy the henchman has with that line, she's clean, and he says, all cats are? Do you call that? And he says that to the security guy, and they're watching her walk in. I feel like there's a weird little undercurrent, a subtext of a strange relationship.
He's just pissed in general. You know, he thought it was a boys club and now his friend is off with this girl. Oh, you know, I get it. Jeez.
This movie has a great compound too. That last sequence in that compound looks like something out of a video game. you know, where you go, the storage facility, the offsite storage facility. I love the way that looks. The biosite facility in this, when it looks futuristic with the red and the blue lights. I mean, all of this. And a lot of time takes place in that bio. That's a huge sequence with him going through the Louvres and then, you know, when she injects herself. That's a huge amount of time they spend in there. Mm. And that whole sequence is directed very, very well.
It's a great sequence. Yeah, probably the best sequence of the movie, really. Right. Yeah.
Makes up for the racetrack sequence, in my opinion, which I think does not work at all. Do you not like that sequence, or is it just me?
It's fine. I mean, I don't know. I think it's not the worst sequence in here. I mean, really, the most ridiculous thing is the motorcycle.
I love the motorcycle.
I knew you would, part? But it is Wait, so
which
stupid.
Which part of the motorcycle? The beginning part of it or the end when they jump off and fly?
When they jump.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. It is so, what are you going to do with the guy you hate?
Well, first of all, it's so Asian. It's very John Woo. And so for that, I love it, but it comes out of nowhere. It really does. And so you're watching this very American action movie and all of a sudden some weird Hong Kong shit happens. And it's not even effective. They just jump into each other's eyes. They just like, it doesn't make any sense.
You know, this movie is also set in Australia. Let's not forget. This came out in the summer of 2000 when the Australian Olympics were out. So this was timed to take a part of that kind of fever, that interesting curiosity people had with Australia. I remember when this came out, people were talking about Australia, Australia, Australia. And this movie really does show Sydney and then the countryside there and, you know, the outback. It is a very Australian heavy, more so than any other setting I can think of for one of these pictures. Because usually they're more globetrotting. This pretty much takes place in just Spain in a very small sequence and then Australia for the most part. Did you care for his team that they brought in? I know they brought in Luther again, but I, for the life of me, can't understand why he has become a fixture of this series other than he's been played by Ving Rhames. Because it's not like he's an interesting character. They never do anything with him. And
he's not even secondary. Yeah, he just shows up and for a couple seconds says some stuff, taps on a computer, and he's done, right?
And Billy Bard, who's the helicopter pilot, has got to be the most useless IMF team member in the entire series. I mean, right? He's got to be the least interesting one of the fucking entire series. That poor bastard's never made a return trip.
Yeah.
He really hasn't. Where do you put this one on your overall ranking of mission movies? If you had to rank the mission movies, where do you go? Run them down, best to worst.
From best to worst, well, I'm going to go 5, 1, 3, 2, and 4.
All right. I'm going to go 2, 5, 1, 3, and 4.
We both put 4 last.
Yeah, well, and we're in the minority once again on that. I mean, for somebody like me to say that I like 2 the best and 4 the worst, I mean, people think I'm nuts, but I just think that 4 gets way bogged down and it's not very fun. And this movie is extremely fun. If you could say anything, you told me after you watched this movie, and this wasn't the alcohol speaking. You said you had kind of a film buzz after this. You got kind of a high from seeing this.
Yeah, it definitely does that to you.
It made me, when I watched it, it made me kind of keen on these kind of movies again in a lot of ways. I wanted to go back and maybe even rewatch the Bourne movies and see if I, you know, didn't see something there. But this movie specifically, I think, is it's so monumental in a lot of ways to me. But I think most likely because I saw this the most out of all of them. I've seen this one the most amount of times. I've tried to break it down the most amount of times. And there's just nothing to break down. It's just there. Everything's on screen. It's supposed to just entertain you in the moment. And it has no fucking apologies for doing that. And I really think that's Cruise's influence as a producer responding to all the criticism, including the criticism that we're going to hear from Ebert and Roper. Let's take a quick second here and listen to Roger Ebert and Richard Roper in one of their first appearances together on the show debate about Mission Impossible 2.
Mission Impossible 2 knows for sure what direction this series should take. It positions its hero, Ethan Hunt, as the James Bond of the 21st century. Tom Cruise stars in a much better movie than the first in the series, fighting to save the world from a deadly virus. The Hong Kong director John Woo, a ranking master of action cinema, showcases Cruise in a streamlined, slicked-down 007 movie with less humor, more serious sex, and almost wall-to-wall action. There's good chemistry between Cruise and Tandy Newton as a master thief whose expertise he needs. Director John Woo has a visual style that doesn't just speed up the action, but breaks it down into separate elements so we get a montage of key moments without too much connecting footage in between. It's effective and exhilarating, and Cruise and Newton bring just enough romance and drama to hold it together.
Well, I think it's interesting that you made all these James Bond references, because this is not a James Bond movie.
No.
We already have James Bond. We've got Pierce Brosnan. This is supposed to be the Impossible Mission Force. It's supposed to be a team of people, but it's not. It's a Tom Cruise movie. It's one of the reasons it didn't work for me. You knew this thing was going to be a huge hit. Tom Cruise knows it's going to be a huge hit. I wish he would have come up with a better script to fit the action scenes. Yeah, the action scenes are great, but so what? People know how to do action scenes. John Woo knows how to film them. Tom Cruise knows how to star in them. And you mentioned the chemistry between him and Tandy Newton. I didn't see that happening either.
Well, you know, of course it's just action scenes. You know, it's June. I think people want to go see a movie like this at the beginning of every summer season. And, of course, it's just Tom Cruise and not a team, because what they've done here is simplify it. They're looking for a franchise.
Then why call it Mission Impossible? Well, I mean, if he wants to do a super spy movie, he should do a super spy. It's really more like Batman.
Yeah, but it's his Mission Impossible. He's given the mission. He does it. He's the hero. He's there all alone on the mountain in the first shot. He's there throughout the entire movie. And that's the way I think this series is going to develop. It's going to forget the rest of the team, forget the TV show, and be Tom Cruise is James Bond for the 21st
century. Well, they should
call
it Mission Piece of Cake, because he's such a cartoon superhero. Nothing bad's ever going to happen to him.
Oh, come on, you enjoyed this movie. Admit it.
I enjoyed certain parts of it, but, you know, I was also uncomfortable with the Tandy Newton romance, because he meets her, he sleeps with her, and then he says, by the way, on our third date, you got to go back and sleep with your ex-boyfriend.
Which is right out of Notorious.
Yeah,
Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman.
It's just kind of creepy. The whole thing was creepy to me. Yeah, the action sequences worked, but I think Tom Cruise has the clout, obviously, to go to his scriptwriters and say, give me more of a story that people can care about.
Well, of course, if you want more of a story, go back to Notorious, where there's a lot of poignancy involving the fact that the woman does what the man she loves asks her to do in order to save her country and so forth. Here it's more cynical, but then here it's 2000 and not 1946.
I'd like to see a more cohesive team effort if it's going to be called Mission Impossible.
All right, those are two varying opinions on this film, and I got to say I'm absolutely in agreement with Ebert on this. I think Ropert wants a different movie altogether, a movie that he would get in 3, 4, and 5, but he missed the point of this movie. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with both of them. I mean, Roper makes a very strong argument. This is, but again, you know, the swinging pendulum. This is a completely different take on this movie. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see this grouping of. This teaming up of characters versus what you finally get with 5, which is very similar, actually. But obviously, I think 5 is slicker when it comes to the team. This really doesn't, he doesn't even need a team in this one.
5 definitely has that nice reversal at the end with Baldwin and Renner. But this has nothing that clever. I think the most clever we get here is Ving Rhames saying Naya's in the building after his truck explodes, and he already, you know, he's in the middle of the hostage negotiation. So I think that's about the most his team does for him.
Well, you do. I mean, Billy Bard, you know, John Paulson, the Australian cat in this is definitely replaced in 4 and 5, I guess, with what's his face?
Simon Pegg.
It was Simon Pegg, right? And because Simon Pegg's really kind of doing that same comedy skit that the Billy Bard character does in this.
And they tried that with John Rhys-Davies, you know, the guy in this, Declan, I think was his name.
Which didn't really work.
No, and they replaced him very quickly, because that was a very, really all they retained from that was a Simon Pegg character, which, so that's why 4 and 5, you know, 3 and 4 are of a piece. If you know, if to put this in the Bond perspective, if Skyfall and Spectre are of the same ilk, then I feel like Mission Impossible 3 and Mission Impossible 4 are almost one continuous movie. They almost look the same. They have the same style. And at least 5 has taken what we've gotten before and gotten it to its optimal running speed. And this one is such the odd man out in the series, because 1 set such a quiet tone. I remember it being such a very quiet movie in the theaters and almost underwhelming because I was expecting, you know, that was the summer of Twister and The Rock and, you know, on and on, Independence Day, all these kind of blockbuster, loud fucking explosion movies. And then you had Mission Impossible, which I was looking forward to, was this really quiet, delicate thriller. And in the pendulum swing, you know, to speak to your point, this goes the exact opposite way and totally is just blowing shit up. I mean, the last hour of this movie really is all action.
But this is kind of the – really, they don't do this much anymore. But you remember when people used to just shoot shit and it blew up?
I love that kind of shit.
This movie, it's great. Yeah,
that is. I love when he goes to reach for the injection gun and they shoot the glass and it falls. I mean, shit like that's Die Hard-esque to me. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, those are the kind of like I don't want to say physics, but kind of like spatial intelligence that movies used to have when before choppy editing made everything one big mush of movement. It used to have kind of a logic to how where stuff was in a frame. And this movie does a great job of letting you know, for the most part, where things are in the frame and where you know where bad guys are. I never got mixed up visually in this movie. And that's a very hard thing to do. And I've always heard that they got Stephen Baird, the editor and sometime director, in to rework this movie. And that's how he got the directing job for Star Trek Nemesis. That was always a rumor that I heard, because he was a notorious fixer as an editor. Credited editors are Christian Wagner and Stephen Kemper. Like I said, this was edited down from apparently 3.5 hours, which I find to be very hard to believe, because even – it's 2 hours and 10 minutes, but even another hour onto this thing has got to be insufferable. But they say there was a longer version, and that's why there are so many quote-unquote plot holes in this. Yeah, I would like to see
it. I want to see it.
I would like to see this guy. But you're right about him being a useless villain, Ambrose, because he doesn't know he doesn't own
– he doesn't really seem to care about being a villain. I really don't – he seems to be fairly bored with pretty much anything, but – he goes through the motions, you know, which is a problem that this movie has a lot, just going through the motions as far as plot goes, you know.
Man, I love that Thandie Newton, though. Good God. She's like a young Zoe Saldana, doesn't she?
I know. I thought the same thing. I was like, wow, this is Thandie Newton is definitely the original Zoe Saldana, as horrible as that may be to say for Zoe Saldana, because she's one of a kind, but
she's a gorgeous woman too. But they have that kind of same look and almost
they had the same start. Look at the movies that they're kind of doing here, you know, 10 years apart.
Yeah, I just love the idea that he sends her back with her former lover, and then, you know, the jealousness. I do love that scene where she says to her, would it make you feel better if I didn't want you to go? And she says, yeah. And he said, well, feel better. You know, that's a nice moment that they had. It's probably the most real moment he has between the two of them in the whole fucking movie, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Because the rest of it's just slow-mo looking at each other.
I do like that. Yeah, I know it. I do like the little jab they put in about portraying Cruise was, you know, grinning like an idiot every 15 minutes was the hardest part. That's a nice little jab that they put in at Cruise's expense here. But for sections of this movie, they don't give Cruise's character anything to do. I mean, when she first gets to the compound and he's just watching, he's basically a voyeur and that's why they have to go to the racetrack. So he at least can meet her and get something from her. But there's no reason.
But that happens in quite a few of these movies where he does just kind of sit back and take a backseat role.
Yeah. He does get my vote, though, in this movie for best head of men's hair ever. Honestly, this is it's like an Indian, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, he had Fabio's hair people.
He had the coif going. He was very well coiffed in this film. I mean, this just reminds me, though, once again, of that late 1990s kind of like that fad, that Antonio Sabato, you know, look where they all had like a long, like, you know what I mean?
I don't think that's who he was trying to imitate, but that's a good one.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like it was a very similar type thing that was going on back then. Lorenzo Lamas.
Yeah, he had it too, yeah.
And like wearing the black tee, the tight black tee, you know, with the suit. It just was a very 90s look.
Every so often, they do try to make long hair very masculine, you know, like tough guys have long hair.
Yeah, well,
this was one of those times.
This was one of those times, but let me tell you what, it took a team of fucking stylists to get that Brazilian blowout going. But once again, this movie was a massive, massive hit at the box office, and I think you can see why. Although it has not held up at all in terms of fan regard, I think I'm the only one holding the torch for it. So, were you upset point, you went back and rewatched it?
No, I'm very happy.
Did you? All right, let me ask you: did you gain a little bit more of an appreciation for it, or does it stay exactly where it was in your mind?
I do like it a little bit more after seeing it with fresh eyes, and especially being in a different time period now. You know, 15, 16 years out. It comparing it to movies nowadays, it just feels a little bit better. You know.
It feels, you know, you talked a while back on one of our podcasts about Pixels and how that made you feel warm and safe in a way. This movie gives me that feeling in a sense where it was a simpler world when this movie came out in a lot of ways, you know, it really was a different time.
Well, I do like, I mean, around this period, MTV Movie Awards, I thought was still you know, funny, at least relevant. With their stuff. Yeah, relevant. I mean, I suppose they're still relevant to certain people, but they were at least funny. I like the sketches and the people involved and stuff. And Ben Stiller was doing the awards show this time. Yeah, and they had a sketch, Mission Improbable. And Cruise and Woo were both in it. And Tom Cruise is always up to make fun of himself. You know, I think is a great thing about him.
And I think that little bond right there would manifest great and paid great dividends later with Les Grossman in Tropic Thunder, where Cruise really, you know, got into character and went the other way. Let's not forget Cruise also appeared mocking himself in Austin Powers, where he kind of, you know, mocked himself there and in quite a few movies where he's been self-deprecating. But this, I mean, first of all, speaking about Mission Improbable, that little sketch, my DVD copy of Mission Impossible 2 had that as one of the special features. My Blu-ray does not include that. Does yours?
No, I bought that box set that came out with 5. I didn't look at the special features on it, but they appear to be with any of those box sets now. You know how they sometimes they're 2-disc sets and they just take out the movie disc and put it in the box set.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what they did with a couple of them. I'm not sure about this one.
Yeah, because the special features on mine, they replaced that for some reason. I don't know if they lost the rights to it or what. You know, there was a video game series for Nintendo 64 and PlayStation for Mission Impossible. They tried to jump on that GoldenEye bandwagon that had taken the nation by storm in 97 and put out a Mission Impossible video game. Unfortunately, it didn't have any likeness rights. So there was no
theme
music. There's
no flowingly beautiful flowing hair.
No, it doesn't look like Cruise at all at any sort of level. Really, it's more fashioned after the first movie. But did you ever play the game?
No.
Oh, it was dog shit. A buddy of mine had it on the 64. It was fucking terrible. It was terrible. In fact, I'm going to play a snippet of the commercial for that game. Well, actually, no, we're not going to play a snippet for that game. That game sucks. But there was a video game snippet for that. I'd rather spare our audience that snippet because that is just a bad snippet anyways. But we are going to leave you guys with some music from the soundtrack with Hans Zimmer.
Yes.
The injection cue, basically, what we were talking about when Naya injects herself with that. But before we do, I want to ask you, do you want to drop anything else into our great show here, our retrospective on Mission Impossible 2? Because I feel like this is a small win personally. I've known you now for over 10 years easily, and I've been a fan of this movie for 15 years, and I've been trying to change your mind on it that entire time, and I feel like this has been a small victory in my life today.
Yeah, I would take it, because I definitely, I don't know, this franchise in general, I've been looking at differently, especially after seeing what's happened with James Bond and Fast and Furious. And now this, at least I feel like going forward, this may change and become more like those, but it's still going to be better than those. Just, you know, I guess I'm really, truly just a Tom Cruise fan.
Yeah.
In all honesty, as crazy as he is, you know, whatever, fine. But as an actor, he really brings something different than other people weren't back then so much and still aren't today. And that's, you know, fragility to his characters and, you know, cockiness that blows up in his face, you know, and that's rare, I think.
There is a consummate professionalism to his performances. And I don't mean that just behind the camera. I mean it like an absolute dedication to a craft that he never gives a lazy performance. You know, you watch a Denzel Washington movie and sometimes he just seems lazy on screen. Like he's not really trying. Like he's playing himself. Cruise, even when times he's playing himself in this movie, it's like, oh, he's being a Tom Cruise character. He's working his ass off. And I always appreciate that, man. He brings it. And whenever an actor brings it repeatedly, you got to respect that. And this is a series that he really he made so much money off these personally that he could try riskier projects. You know, he made $75 million as a producer off this film alone. That's unbelievable. So this was a huge, huge coup for him. And really, this is kind of the beginning of that crazy Cruise era that we're going into the next 5 years. But I'm glad we weathered that, and he's back in favorable standing. And we're talking this year once again of him being, you know, one of the last great movie stars, because he's back in the conversation of that again. Now you just need an Oscar. We want to leave you all with the sounds of Hans Zimmer and Injection from the score of Mission Impossible 2. Speaking for Trevor Anderson, I'm Jason Rugard, and we are the Movie Mavericks.